good morning, TNC family, on this first Sunday in August, where we're starting a brand new four-part series here, exploring four universal human experiences. The experience of wanting, desiring, the experience of failing, not meeting an expectation or a goal, the experience of praying, trying to connect with the divine, and finally, the experience of winning, of accomplishing an objective, where we'll look at common denominators that exist among folks who achieve objectives. The series is called When You Want, When You Fail, When You Pray, and When You Win. Not if, but when. And we'll explore what causes these universal experiences, what dangers exist in them, and how we can live through them with greater joy and wisdom. So, let's jump in. And I want to start now with this. The first book of the Bible, Genesis and chapter 3, and the story of the serpent tempting Eve and then Adam, a crafty serpent preying on the cravings of humans, and it all plays out in the first 10 verses of chapter 3. The serpent gets the woman to want, to desire, to crave something that seems good to her in the moment, to want to taste, try, and experience something forbidden, to eat the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the text says that the woman sees that the fruit is good for food and pleasing to the eye and desirable for gaining wisdom. And so she wants it. She wants. But turns out what she wants in that moment is not what she wants most for her entire life. Something she won't learn until after the moment of craving has passed. And we'll come back to this story in a second, and to your life and to mine, but I came across something fascinating some time ago, and I think it explains part of what is happening inside Eve's heart and mind in her moment of wanting. It's from the work of Kent Berridge. He's currently a professor of biopsychology and neuroscience at the University of Michigan, and he is known for his work on the brain systems for pleasure. And he was studying how desire, motivation, temptation, wanting, how it works. And one of the discoveries he made is, turns out that how much you want something is surprisingly unrelated to the amount of joy you'll receive later, if and when you get it. Because the anticipation or the craving for something is located in its own unique part of the brain, separate from how you evaluate something after you've got it. Now, Eve in Genesis 3 is in anticipation mode, and the anticipation or the want of something is driven by neurotransmitters called dopamine. Dopamine drives what we want. Now, hang with me on this. Berridge and his team studied this with rats, and what they did was give the rats sugar water and then had a whole system to rank and quantify how much the rats liked the sugar water. And I won't go into how they figured out all of that here, but like just imagine a taste test for you and for me where it's discovered that we like Coca-Cola better than Pepsi, Sprite better than 7-Up, and Dr. Pepper best of all. And Berridge did something similar to this with rats. He gave them sugar water and various recipes and ratios of sugar to water until he saw, based on his system of ranking and quantifying, that the rats were experiencing maximum tasting pleasure. But then he and his team artificially diminished the dopamine levels in the rats' brains. They slowly decreased the dopamine levels, and as they did this, at very first, the rats still went for the sugar water. They just didn't run towards it. But they eventually would drink the water, and when they did, they loved it as much as ever. But over time, decreased the dopamine. They crave it less and less and less, and sometimes they would finally drink it, and when they did, they would like it as much as ever. But eventually, their wanting for it was so diminished, their dopamine levels were so low, that they would starve themselves rather than make their way over to where the sugar water was. And then, now listen to this, Berridge did the opposite. He and his team wanted to see if they could make the rats want something they didn't even like, and so they made the water bitter and brackish, but artificially increased the rats' dopamine level. And he could tell after they tasted it, they did not like the bitter water, but as long as they kept increasing the dopamine levels, didn't matter, the rats wanted it. More and more and more, they could not resist the temptation, even though what they wanted was distasteful and unsatisfying, which turns out, TNC, this is the way temptation works. It will engage our dopamine centers, our wants, our cravings, and sometimes we'll want things that aren't even good for us after getting them. Now, this is what we see playing out, I think, with Eve and Adam in Genesis chapter 6. The serpent gets the humans to want to disobey God, to want to taste, try, experience something forbidden, to want to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the text says the woman ate and gave some to Adam, and he ate. And we don't know how many bites they took or how long their afternoon snack lasted, but we do know this. There is no record of them saying, "Wow, this is delicious. Let's go pick another. I'm so happy I ate this." Instead, the result is negative. They realize they are naked. They feel ashamed. They hide from God and they blame each other because what they wanted at the time of temptation wasn't what they actually most wanted for their overall life. And now, let's talk about you and me. Because much of the pain that we will experience in life, much of the pain that you will experience in life is linked to the choices you make because of what you want in the moment, even though what you want in the moment isn't always what you want most. Or as Nobel Prize winning economist Daniel Kahneman puts it, nothing in life is as important as you think it is while you are thinking about it. That snack at midnight, that car that cuts you off in morning traffic, that new advertisement telling you about the upgrade, holding the remote, moving to a state with less income taxes or better weather, that thing I'm angry about and that thing I want to complain about, it's just not as important to the well-lived life as you think it is while you are thinking it. And this is exactly what the Apostle Paul is getting at in his New Testament letters. In Romans 7, for example, he writes in chapter 7, "I don't really understand myself, for at the end of the day, I always want to do what is right, but in the moment, I don't do it. Instead, in the moment, I do what I hate, what is not good, what is wrong." Verse 24, "Who will save me from this body of death?" And then verse 25, "Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord." There is a way, Paul says. There is a hope. And then he goes on to dissect this problem. And then in Romans chapter 8, verse 5 and 6, he writes, "Those who live according to the sinful nature have their minds set on what that nature desires, but those who live in accordance with the Spirit of God have their minds set on what the Spirit desires." It starts in the mind, Paul says, and in what we have our minds set on. Now, this always reminds me of the book Mind Gym, where author and performance coach Gary Mack talks about what he calls the law of dominant thought. The law of dominant thought, which says that your most dominant thought will dominate your actions in the moment. And so he writes about the golfer who arrives at the tee of a hole with water on the left. And the first thing the golfer does is dig out an old ball, a water ball, out of his golf bag. And the second thing he does is say to himself, "Don't hit the ball in the water." And Mack, who studies the mind in his book, says that actions will follow our thoughts and our images. And if you say, "Don't hit it in the water," and you're looking at the water, you've just programmed your mind to send the ball to a watery grave. Think water, remember water, and water likely is what you'll get. I'm discouraged. My job stinks. My income is unfair. My kids are pests. That's what you'll get. Instead, Max says you should say to yourself, land the ball 10 yards to the right of the pin. Instead, my job is an amazing challenge to my patience. My level of income is really teaching me how to be generous, even though things are tight. My kids have so much energy and relentless determination, I can't wait to see how they're going to unleash that for greater purpose. As the wisest man who ever lived, the great King Solomon wrote, Proverbs 23, as a person thinks in his or her heart, so is that person. Or as baseball great Ty Cobb was famous for saying, the most important part of the player's body is above his shoulders. Or as David Goggins, retired U.S. Navy SEAL, American ultramarathon runner, triathlete, public speaker, author of two best-selling memoirs, writes, quote, the most important conversations you'll ever have are the ones you'll have with yourself. And so now we should imagine Eve and what conversations she's having with herself that day, the day she ate the fruit. And Adam and what conversations he had with himself that day he ate the fruit. Because what happened is their dopamine centers took over, and what they wanted in the moment was not what they wanted most. And what they most needed was a different conversation in their mind. Now, that may not be all they needed, but it would have been a wise starting place. And it's the same for us, I think, when we come to moments of temptation, of craving, of wanting something in the moment that may not be what we want most. In that moment, we need a different conversation. Not, here comes the water ball, but rather, how can I land the ball 10 yards to the right of the pin? And I want to suggest now that this conversation with yourself can be successful if it's driven by two questions, two conversation-starting questions. And I think this is at least part of what Paul is getting at when he writes to the church at Corinth in his letter, chapter 10 and verse 5, we should take every thought captive to the ways of God. So let me suggest two questions to ask yourself when you find yourself in the valley of craving, of temptation, of wanting something you don't have. Here's question number one. Am I alone? Am I alone? Because if the answer is yes, then you are more likely to choose something you will later regret. The classic example of this would be, am I more likely to eat a half dozen donuts while you are watching me? Or when I'm alone? Am I more likely to click on that if you're watching me or if I'm alone? Or take the opposite idea, am I more likely to exercise, do something good if I'm walking with a friend or if I'm alone? See, the general principle is it's easier to do, to engage in the right thing when you're with somebody, and it's harder to do the wrong thing as well. Or as the writer of Ecclesiastes chapter 4 says, though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves, and a cord of three strands is not quickly broken. And so imagine that Adam and Eve are walking together, not alone. Further, imagine they're walking with God, as the text says they often did. Imagine all three are walking together when they come upon the forbidden fruit. See, TNC, having strong, wise social bonds is probably the most meaningful contributor to your happiness and joy and progress in life. We need each other. We're stronger together. We think better together. And by the way, the opposite is also true. We are far more irrational all by ourselves. I'm saying there's something about being with other wise, loving people where if I actually, within a circle of friendship, we'll name an idea, thought, worry, dream, craving. If I name it in a circle of friends, then its reasonableness or unreasonableness becomes much clearer. Think about it like this. Everything becomes clearer in the light. Everything becomes less clear in the dark, in hiddenness. Yet sometimes there's something about us that wants to keep things quiet. precisely because I want to retain the option to go to that dark place, the dark side, but which is why aloneness is a very prominent feature of people who struggle, who descend, who decline. When you don't access accountability, you create limitations on your life. And when you engage in healthy community, you create opportunities for your life. So first question, when you have this internal conversation in your mind, ask the question, are you craving alone? Are you alone? And if so, be aware. Okay, and then the second question to start the conversation in your mind. Second question, am I surrendered? Here's what I mean. In the moment of your temptation, of your craving, of your want, are you leaning into your own wants, your own wisdom, or into the wisdom of someone who might be wiser? I think now of Proverbs chapter 3, verse 7. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Don't assume you know it all. Or Proverbs 29. Pride brings a person low, but humility prepares you for honor. Or Proverbs 22, verse 4. The payoff for humility and trust in the Lord is plenty and honor and a satisfying life. I've shared before from the book, The Death of Expertise by Tom Nichols, the professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. He tells the story of one day when he was lecturing at Harvard University, and after the lecture, a student came up and they entered a conversation about strategic military affairs. And at some point in the conversation, the student says, quote, well, professor, your guess is as good as mine. And Nichols responded, actually, your guess is not as good as mine. And in the book, Nichols shows how across many fields of expertise, science, law, medicine, politics, military affairs, people dismiss expertise and they do so with frequency and with passion. But the truth is, and he shows this, experts are more often right than wrong. And yet people constantly search for the loopholes in expert knowledge that will allow them to disregard all expert advice they don't like. So here's the wisdom. Ask yourself, who am I listening to? Who am I trusting? Who am I surrendered to in this moment of craving? Imagine Eve asking herself that question. Her answer would be, me. I'm trusting myself. But imagine for a moment if she had let go of her need to be an expert in this situation and trusted God. Way easier said than done. But just imagine if she had said, I don't understand it. I don't know why, but I'm just going to trust God here. I'm going to let go of my need to be in charge. Which, and maybe you saw Indiana Jones 5. I have yet to see it, but I have seen the first four. The first three came out in the 1980s, and the third, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, it's the story of how Indiana Jones is obsessed with finding the Holy Grail. He craves its discovery. What do you want more than anything else? The Holy Grail. And at the end of the movie, the Grail, a cup, is lying in a crack in the ground after an earthquake in a cave, and Indiana Jones is being supported by his dad, played by Sean Connery, and he is millimeters from being able to reach the Grail, Indiana Jones is, which is soon about to fall further into the crack. And what his father sees clearly, but Indiana does not, in his momentary lust for the Grail, is if he insists on reaching for it, he will die. It will cost him his life. Dad, I can almost get it. Let it go, son. But Dad, let it go. Take my hand, Indy. Let it go. And those are the words some of us need now to hear today, this season, TNC. Let go. Let go. Let it go. Now, it doesn't mean to cling to nothing. It means to cling to the hand of the Father. I think here, of course, of the words of Proverbs chapter 3, verse 5 and 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not to your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths. And I think that's a great place for us to end. So I'm going to pray now, and specifically for that thing that you are craving, that you are wanting. And I want to pray for your discernment around it, for the conversations you're going to have with yourself about it. So let's pray together. God, I pray now for every person listening, and I bring to our attention that thing that we crave, a new situation, a new experience, a new opportunity. And my prayer is that first we would find the right circle of friends to express this craving. Maybe just start with one trusted, wise friend. And God, I pray that this TNC community would continue to be a stronger and stronger place for godly friendships and support. And then second, God, I pray a prayer of surrender, that in this moment now we would surrender our worry about it and our fears about it and our emotions around it, that we would let them go and reach out to you. And of course, we'll have to do this again and again and again. But for now, for this moment, in this moment, we surrender that craving to you and ask that you would lead us in the next step of our journey and that you would direct our paths. Now, TNC, I pray that the Lord would bless you and keep you, make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you, turn his face towards you, and give you peace. Amen.